Now for this hour, we'd like to talk about a primary turning point in the life of Jacob. And it came while he was on a journey. He was on a trip. This was a critical turning point in Jacob's life. It happened as he was on his way back to his homeland in Canaan. Now, you've titled this Jacob's Midlife Crisis, even though he was probably about 65. However, Jacob lived until he was 147. So that makes 65 a relatively early midlife crisis. In order to get the power of this section, which is the narrative of Jacob's wrestling all night with a man, which is this critical turning point in his life, we need to review something of what had gone on in order to understand what goes on in any major crisis or major turning point in our own lives. We need to go back and review what has gone on in the past in order to make sense out of what is going on in this turning point. And we need to begin with Jacob's birth. He was a twin, and he came out of his mother's womb holding on to the heel of his brother Esau. Therefore, he was named Jacob, which in Hebrew sounds like the Hebrew word for heel. Now, this matter of name we will deal with when we get to this crisis. But naming and a person's name is of critical importance in Hebrew culture and Hebrew thought. And you notice how often it says in the Old Testament that such and such happened, therefore the child was named thus and so. Names gave identity. Esau, it says, was a hunter. He liked the out-of-doors. But Jacob was a quiet man, stayed at home. And then there's a really potent phrase that says that Isaac loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And people of Freudian training and orientation could just have a real field day with that. Jacob was a mama's boy. And being the favorite of his mother, that, of course, in Freudian thought, is supposed to cause all kinds of problems. Well, then, of course, the story about how Jacob traded some food with his brother Esau for his birthright. Esau came back one day hungry and tired, and Jacob had some nice food on the fire, and Esau said, "I want some of that." Jacob said, "Give me your birthright." Esau was tired. He said, I'm going to die anyway. What good will that do me?" And then, of course, the next scene is when it comes time for Isaac to give the birthright. And Jacob's mother calls him aside and says, "Here's how you're going to get the birthright." And so Isaac is deceived by Jacob preparing some food that tastes like wild game, but which isn't, and by putting a goatskin on him, because Esau had a lot of hair, and Isaac was almost blind, and so when Jacob came, Isaac thought it was Esau. Of course, Esau comes back later, and he and Isaac find out that Isaac has been fooled and Jacob had been given the birthright. Esau says, "Well, give it to me. It was you gave it to Jacob because you were fooled. Now take it back. Give it to me." Isaac says, "No, I can't." And this is one other fascinating thing about the Hebrew thought, that once any words are spoken, first of all, they cannot be taken back. And secondly, the spoken word carries literally the reality which those words symbolize. That paternal blessing, once having been spoken to Jacob, could not be taken back. No way, not in Hebrew thought. We might think about how careless we are with the spoken word and how we are barraged with words. Hebrews were very careful. Hebrew has only about 3,000 words in its total vocabulary, while Greek, for example, has over 10,000. So Hebrews were careful how they spoke. Well, of course, it's no longer healthy for Jacob to stay at home, and so he has to leave. Esau is bound on vengeance. And so Jacob takes off for his mother's relatives. On his way, he has a dream in which God spoke to him. And we might note in passing that in both the Old and the New Testaments, God spoke often to people through dreams. And we may feel as though that's something that only belongs in the pages of the Bible. In our time, there is an increasing number of people who are convinced that our dreams are still very meaningful, and that sometimes God can speak to us through dreams. That may sound a bit weird for some of you, but those who have studied this and have dealt with it, many within the church, have come to realize that this is not something that was only in the pages of the Bible, but that this is one of the means that God sometimes uses. It's a fascinating subject. Well, Jacob goes on and he meets his relatives, and then he runs into this little incident of he asks his relative Laban for, he asked for his daughter Rachel, because Rachel was lovely and beautiful, and Laban says, sure, you just work 7 years for me and you can have Rachel. And comes the wedding, or comes rather came the morning after the wedding, Jacob woke up to find it was Leah. And he's a bit disturbed, and he says, well, went to Laban and says, what's going on here? Laban said, it is our custom that the oldest daughter is married first. But if you want Rachel, you can work another 7 years. So he did. Jacob got some of his own medicine, you see. Well, this is the point at which in the adult development terminology we can say that Jacob was settling down. He was entering the adult world, so to speak, getting married, and then he starts in his highly productive phase, which in our time is typical of the man as he hits his 30s. He's decided what he's going to do, and he's going to make it. He's going to work hard. He's going to become successful. And that's exactly what Jacob does. He starts out by taking the scrubs of his father-in-law's flocks. But through some very wise and clever breeding practices, Jacob ends up with larger flocks, stronger animals, and he's on top of the world. He's got wives, he's got children, he's got hundreds of animals, sheep, goats, cattle, camels, donkeys, slaves. He's made it. He has arrived. He is successful. Now, as is so often true in that situation, just at the point when a man thinks he's got the world by the tail, he's made it, something happens, something begins to shift, and all of a sudden, this sitting on top of the world becomes very shaky. This is precipitated by Laban becoming jealous. Jacob has become too successful. Laban figures that it has been at his expense, and therefore it is no longer safe for Jacob to stay with his father-in-law. So he gathers up his flocks and his family, and he's going back home. Now, as Jacob is on his way back home, he begins to be concerned, because if he goes back home, he's going to meet Esau. Esau had been bent on vengeance. And so Jacob is headed for what we're calling his midlife crisis. Now, note that, and for Jacob, this is a crisis of faith. It's a spiritual crisis. But note that his crisis of faith comes out of the stuff of which his daily life is made. His crisis of faith comes out of his daily living. That is, his relationship with his brother. It is precipitated by his situation with his father-in-law. The ordinary stuff of daily life. And it's his having to break with his father-in-law that's the first step of this life crisis. So, he's on his way back and he thinks now about Esau. And he realizes that Esau was bent on vengeance and most likely still is. So, Jacob uses his head. He's been clever for all these years. He's still clever. He sends messengers to Esau on before him. He tells the messengers, "Tell my brother Esau that I'm coming, that I have a large family, that I have vast flocks of livestock and many slaves, and I pray that I will find favor in your sight." He figures that ought to impress Esau so that he might forget about his vow of vengeance. The messengers don't get to give the message to Esau because they see, before they get to Canaan, they see Esau coming with 400 men. They assume that Esau's coming with an army to wipe out Jacob. And so they don't even get to talk to Esau. They come tearing back to Jacob and they tell him, "Esau's coming with 400 men. Well, now's when the crisis begins to pinch. Still, Jacob is using his own cleverness. He divides his family and his flocks into two groups, figuring that if one of them gets wiped out by Esau and his 400 men, the other group might survive. But he's not really positive that that's going to do it. And so in his panic and in his desperation, he prays. And he tells God, "Now you promised me, God, you promised me that my descendants would be as numerous as the sands on the seashore and all of that. Now, God, you better get me through this." But then he doesn't really count on God because he's still got one more strategy. He takes some sheep and some goats and some cattle and some camels and some donkeys. And he tells his servants, "Now you put these 20, 30, 40 of each, whatever it is, put them into separate groups, put some space in between them, and you take them to Esau, group by group. And maybe then if Esau isn't calmed down with the first gift, here a short distance behind comes a second gift, and a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, and so on." You see, Jacob's still relying on his cleverness. He's still going by the old way of doing things, his old way of doing things, which is to live by his wits. He's clever to live by his competence. And you see, that's what we always do. Whenever we come smack up against a major life crisis, our old way of doing things we think is still going to work. The way we have functioned, the way we have thought, the values that we've used and live by, the kind of behaviors that we've used, we still try to use them even though we're in this crisis, and we know at a deep level that the old way of doing things, the old way of living, isn't going to work anymore. But we still hang on to it because that's all we know. But then comes the night before the day when he's going to meet Esau. And now we come to our core of the crisis. Jacob sends all of his flocks and all of his servants and his family on before him on the other side of the river Jabbok. And after he had sent his family across and sent across all that he owned, he stayed behind alone. And you see, at some point in any major life crisis, all of the things that we'd counted on, our competence, our possessions, our role, all those things fall away. And each of us is left totally alone without any visible means of support. So then a man came and wrestled with him until just before daybreak. When the man saw that he was not winning the struggle, he hit Jacob on the hip, and it was thrown out of joint. The man said, "Let me go, daylight is coming." "I won't unless you bless me," Jacob answered. "What is your name?" the man asked. "Jacob," he answered. The man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob. You have struggled with God and with men, and you have won. So your name will be Israel." And the name Israel means he struggles with God. Now, a couple of things to notice. The story is that Jacob is wrestling with a man. This is the story form, the symbolic form of Jacob struggling to hold on to his old way of doing things, even though he knows those ways no longer work. All of his possessions, his role as a wealthy person, father, husband, all those things are for nothing. But he doesn't want to let go of them. His struggle is with God. And he just cannot afford to let go of his old identity. He has defined himself as a wealthy person, as a clever person, as a competent person, but now this crisis is upon him, and he understands only too well that all of those things won't really make one whit of difference with Esau. If Esau is bent on vengeance, all the cattle and camels in the world won't change Esau's mind. But still he hangs on to it. He's in this contradictory situation. Exactly the way in which the kind of situation in which we find ourselves when we realize that the way in which we've functioned up to this point isn't going to work anymore. We know that at one level, but we still hang on to the old ways. Jacob almost wins. And in the story, the man has to strike him on the hip and put his hip out of joint. so that he is unable to continue wrestling. But he still won't let go of the man. Remember, when Jacob was born, he was born holding on to the heel of his brother. He's still holding on. He won't let this man go. Jacob says, I won't let you go unless you bless me. And then comes this, the new name. Your name shall no longer be Jacob. It shall be Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men. It is at this point, you see, that Jacob is given a new identity, and he accepts it. And from this point on in his life, he no longer lives by his wits. He is a different kind of person. He has a new understanding of the promise of God. He has a new understanding of his response. He has a new understanding of his dependence upon God. We might in passing note that there was another character in the New Testament who was given a new name when he was in a life crisis. Saul's name was changed to Paul. Symbolic of the new identity of this person. Saul, who had persecuted the church, met Christ on the road. Another journey. He met Christ on the road. And out of it, he was given a new name, Paul, which symbolized that he was a different person. He had a new kind of identity. Well, this is one of the critical issues of any major turning point in our lives, which for many people happens in midlife. We think we've got the world by the tail. We think we know who we are. Be it competent worker, competent parent, father or mother, whatever. And at some point in our middle years, often the old roles, the old way of doing things no longer work. And it's sort of like the, without picking on women at all, mothers who won't let go of their children, even when it's time for them to be out on their own. You see, those mothers won't let go of the old way of doing things. The old way was right and proper when the children were young and growing up. But that way of functioning is no longer right. It no longer works at the point when the children are ready to leave home. You can't be mother to a 25 or 30-year-old in the same way that you're mother to a 12-year-old. Sometimes mothers try to do that, and of course, it doesn't work. Or men in their work. As we talked about for those of you that were here on Tuesday, we talked about the middle adult era and the what for many people is a midlife crisis. You come to a point in your work when all that you've worked for suddenly turns to ashes. It's meaningless. Just at the point when you'd figured that you had everything under control, it just no longer seems to be working. And you see, this is what happened with Jacob. He had power, he had wealth, he had status, but all of that was for nothing when it came down to this point of crises. And you see, if we have defined ourselves, if we have defined who we are, if we have determined our identity by what we have done, by our roles as parent, or what have you, there comes that time when all of those things are of no use. And whatever I've been doing, whatever I have accumulated, whatever I've gathered in the way of status, doesn't mean anything. And when we come to that point, then we say, well, who am I now? Now, maybe most of us, I'm sure none of us have had or will have as traumatic a midlife crisis as did Jacob. We aren't going to be in precisely that kind of situation. And it may be that in talking about Jacob, that Jacob may have been chosen by God to be the channel for the continuation of the covenant promise. But Jacob still had to become God's person in a new way in order for that covenant promise to be fulfilled. Now, in Ephesians, Paul says that God chose us, in one translation, God chose us from the foundation of the world to be in union with Christ. God chose us before the world was created to be one with Christ. That may be true for all of us, and we claim that promise. That's a marvelous thing to know, that God chose us even before the foundation of the world was laid to be His. But in order for that promise to be fulfilled in us, we need to become God's persons in new ways as we move along our life journey. Now, these crises can be triggered not usually by something that comes out of the blue, out of the sky. Notice that Jacob's crises of faith came out of the stuff of his daily life. And that's the stuff of which our life crises are made. That's our faith crises. As Christians, you see, we meet crises of faith, life crises, out of the stuff of our daily lives. And in each major life transition, the intention of God is that we acquire a new identity that is appropriate for that coming season of life. Our basic sense of identity, of course, comes out of our baptism. That's who we fundamentally always are as long as we live. We are God's person. But how we understand that, the shape of that God-given baptismal identity changes at critical points throughout our adult lives. And one understanding of who we are may be suitable for one season of our life, but it is not suitable for other seasons. And so, this is why it is so important for us to understand that even though we have these critical turning points, when we may feel as though there is nothing to hold on to in life, we all come to those points. That's the way in which we can grow. That's the way we have been created. The two themes that I've used this week are that God has created us for growth, lifelong growth. You don't stop growing when you're 20 or 40 or 60 or 80. We have been created for lifelong growth. And secondly, genuine growth always involves pain. That's the way life is. That's how genuine growth comes. Think about Jacob's adult life journey and see how it might reflect some of your own. Uh, One of the things that is important for all of us as we think about this journey of life is what other people have experienced in terms of life crises, in terms of feeling abandoned and then gaining a new sense of identity and a new, and therefore a new sense of purpose. I would like to hear from you, your comments, your reactions, some of your stories. That's the most valuable part of this kind of thing. Any comments, questions, reactions, stories?
Well, I'm wondering what the necessity of struggle is in the experience of grace.
What was the last thing you said?
What is the necessity of struggle in the experience of grace?
Most of us do not willingly let go of the old way. Most of us do not willingly let go of the old identity. We are not passive creatures. And it is only when we have struggled and have come to an understanding that the struggle is in vain that I believe that we really know what grace means. And I would go even further to say that if we don't struggle, we probably won't grow. We probably won't know grace. Because there's a poster. I don't know, those of you that may have been here last week may have heard my wife refer to this. She has a poster in her office that says, "When do people change?" That's at the top. At the bottom it says, "When they have to, and not 1 minute before." and you see, that I think is one way of answering your question. We don't understand at a gut level the meaning of God's grace until we have exercised all of our resources, until we get thoroughly convinced that those really don't work. But some of us are harder to convince than others. And we can hear the message of God's grace. We can hear it, and isn't that lovely? Isn't that marvelous? But it only gets about this far. And it's not until we struggle through some life experience that we get an understanding of God's grace down here. But try to tell someone who's 35 years old that. Yeah. I see. If you come to that, you see that's a marvelous sign of growth and maturity. But not everybody comes to that understanding easily. This is one of the things that is one of the points we're going to deal with in the Bible study tomorrow morning, which is on Ecclesiastes 3, which has to do with life transitions. And one of the things we're going to deal with is that there is a time for everything, and afterwards we understand that God, that there's a profound sense in which we can say God set that time without getting into the pitfall of predestination. Afterwards we can see that. But you see, that's why when you feel a life crisis coming on, provided it's not something that zaps you, you know, like right now, then there isn't time. But sometimes we are fortunate and we can feel things beginning to get out of sync. And that should tell us something's happening, something's going to change. And that's one of the points at which it is good for us to look back and see how God has dealt with us in the past and it may give us some clues as to how he may be dealing with us now.
I think that's the hard part, though, what he said, is it's waiting, knowing that God is working in your life, but boy, his thoughts are in yours.
That's right. This too we'll talk about in more depth tomorrow morning. This in-between time, which has been called the wilderness time, when we're sort of wandering, waiting, there seems to be no, it's a time of chaos. It's a time when we feel absolutely deserted. There are some things we can do that if we can recognize that's where we are, there are some things we can do, and we'll talk about that tomorrow morning, but those are tough times.
I think a lot of us, I'm sure most of us, went through the Depression.
Yeah.
And so becoming affluent became extremely important to us.
Yes.
Because when we were young, there was nothing for a lot of us.
Yep.
And then as we get older, that is so important, and we're in such a habit of being busy, that has made conflict with our children. And so our children love a place like Holden, where they go back to the natural,
right,
and criticizing us. So that has made a problem for us, too.
Yes. Yes, it's a very real, I have many memories from the 30s. One is, I can recall that my dad bought me a used bicycle, and it was $15. And after one day, he had to take it back to get his money back. He bought it in a very generous gesture, and then after he and my mother talked about it, that $15 just couldn't go for a bicycle. And so, right on, those of us that have, and those who are a bit older and who had responsibilities during those years, when times changed, then having some measure of financial security became unduly important. And that needs some rethinking. Yeah.
Perhaps this is somewhat of a new tack on this story, but how can we, getting back to Jacob, anticipate or know the crises that we're facing through other people? In other words, Jacob was wrong in a way of judging Esau.
Yes.
So how can we detect and work with our fellow people, knowing that they have a crisis, but what we can do to help them? And to judge right. In other words, it would not be easier for Jacob if he'd have known that Esau was favorable to him at that time.
That might not have changed that.
Yeah, these are things. If I hear your question right, one of the things that we need is what we call in jargon terms a support system, friends. And if we've got a group of people, if we're part of a network of a friend support system, we know one another. We can sense when somebody's even in a minor kind of transition, because life transitions aren't always major and just catastrophic like this. They can be relatively minor, but we can sense in other people when something is going on, and we can be the hand that is extended to that person when we sense they might be in this wilderness or in this lonely time, the time when they feel that there's nobody else there. And we can be the ones that convey in tangible human form that God is there with them. That's how God uses us. And isn't that what we would like the fellowship of the church to be? And if there's time tomorrow morning, we're going to touch on that one too, that what we would like the church to be in as a structure and what it turns out to be.
Do you feel that everyone has some time of crisis in their life?
Everyone goes through major and minor adult life transitions. Yeah. We all experience losses of one kind or another, changes, shifts. Now, sometimes, by the luck of the draw, by the way in which our bodies, minds, and spirits have been put together in terms of, you know, some of us may pick the right parents. And we're, and we cope more easily than many others do. But anytime we lose a good friend, we lose a spouse, we get ill, there's any change in our work life, change in our role, we're in a transition and we have to work some things through. And most people have some kind of major shift at some point in their middle years, somewhere between 35 and 50, whatever. At some point and sometimes it's gradual and relatively painless, but sometimes it can be quite painful. But if we're going to grow, we need to change our sense of who we are. We need to gain new understandings of our identity as God's persons. Because what is right and functional and healthy for us at 25 is most likely not going to work very well when we're 50. Or 70.
You don't always have the opportunity to choose when you're going to go down. The Lord pulled the rug out from underneath a year and a half ago. My husband had been retired almost 10 years. We came down from a vacation down the mountains and he died the next day.
Yeah.
That's a shock.
Yes, it is. That's, you see, there's always a possibility. Those of you that saw my neat adult life journey scheme on the board, there's always a possibility at any point of an outside intervention that puts us into a transition and we need to redefine ourselves. And we're put into the pits.
Well, and all of us have been blessed with certain abilities, certain talents, certain material things, and I guess the problem, at least for me, comes in is how best am I to use this, or how does God want me to use this?
Right.
You know, a lot of people say very easily, as far as I'm concerned, well, God wants me to do this, and God wants me to do that. Boy, that's where I have the trouble. I don't know what God wants me to do.
Yeah, I'm not going to question anyone who sounds so positive as to, you know, they always seem to know what God wants them to do. There are times, and there are those people, and I'll accept it, who can say with that kind of certainty, for most of us, most of the time, it's not that clear.
It wasn't that clear for Paul, for sure.
Nope. No, and you know, if there are those for whom the will of God is that clear and that precise, great. It has seldom been that for me. And once again, it's often only afterwards that I realize, yeah, this is what God wanted me to do. This is right. But I wasn't that sure moving into it.
Don't all your acquaintances drop you when you get in trouble? Like when a husband dies, well, then they have to find another person like them. They don't want them unless they have a husband like they are.
You use the word acquaintances, and I think that's probably an accurate choice of a word. real friends aren't going to drop you. And that's why one of, and we'll be talking, that's one of the things we'll be talking about this evening at 7 o'clock, is the importance of having friends you can count on. The importance of being open to other people so that you aren't going to be dropped because your life circumstance changes. That if people that you thought were friends do drop you when your life situation changes, that can sort of be a double whammy, can't it?
Sometimes I think it may be an advantage.